Okay, so thank you very much for the invitation here. I will be talking about some work that I have been doing during my PhD studies at King's College London in collaboration with my supervisor, Nick Mavromatos, and also with Jean Alexander. And towards the end of my talk, I will also talk a little bit about some work which is still in progress. And this, again, work with Nick, but also with Mary Sakellariadou and with Ferkan Youssef, again, at King's. So the main focus of my talk will be on a technique for finding time-dependent background fields for string theory that are exact in algebra. So we know that string theory is at present the main candidate for a fundamental theory of quantum gravity, as it includes in its spectrum a graviton state, and as the effective theory for this field gives Einstein's gravity at scales much larger than the string length. I will start with a brief introduction to strings, focusing on the conformal properties of the world sheet theory and on how these affect the physics in the target spacetime. Then I will present a specific configuration, which will be a time-dependent graviton, dilaton, and tachyon background. And I will claim that this satisfies the conformal invariance conditions for the closed bosonic string to an arbitrary order in alpha prime up to a field redefinition, up to a suitable field redefinition, due to some properties that that we have called homogeneity, and I will explain more about this. The graviton background I will propose corresponds to a de Sitter metric in the sigma model frame, and under certain conditions, it also stays de Sitter in the Einstein frame, while the tachyon and the dilaton fields are linear in time. Towards the end of my talk, I will also discuss a possible other application of the same technique, namely a deep particle foam model, in which we have also a time-dependent gauge field background, which can be shown in the same way to be exact in alpha prime. So we know that strings are one-dimensional objects that propagate in a d-dimensional spacetime, and when we quantize the string coordinates, we get a spectrum of states, with the lowest one being a tachyon, a scalar field, and then at the massless level we have two tensors, the graviton and the antisymmetric tensor, and a scalar field, the dilaton. These states can be introduced as background fields for the world sheet theory, with their zero modes playing the role of couplings in the theory. But they can also be regarded as dynamical fields for the effective theory in the target spacetime. During most of my talk, I will be focusing on closed string backgrounds, but the technique can also be applied to open strings, which include gauge fields in their spectrum as well. Conformal invariance is very important for string theory, as it reflects the fact that the physics in the target spacetime should be independent of the way we parameterize our world sheet. The invariance of the theory under diffeomorphisms on the world sheet is automatically preserved at the quantum level, but the invariance of the theory under scalings, under wild scalings of the world sheet metric, is anomalously broken at the quantum level. To preserve this symmetry, we need to impose certain conditions, namely that the wild anomaly coefficients beta I vanish. So if we have a set of background fields di, in our case, this will be mainly the graviton, the dilaton, and the tachyon. Since these are treated as couplings for the worldship theory, we can associate a beta function to each one of them. And then the Weyl anomaly coefficient beta I associated to GI will essentially be this beta function, which describes the renormalization group flow of the coupling with respect to the Weyl scaling parameter, plus some other corrections that take care of diffeomorphisms in the target spacetime. By setting these conditions on the background fields, we actually have a tool for going from the worldship theory to the effective theory in the target space. When the conformal invariance conditions are written out explicitly, when the betas are written out explicitly, they look like equations of motion for the background fields. For example, here I have written out the Weyl anomaly coefficients for the graviton, beta, g, mu, nu, for the dilaton, and for the tachyon, assuming that the antisymmetric tensor is zero. The beta functions are usually computed as expansions in alpha prime, and here I have only included the first orders in alpha prime. Of course, here all the indices mu and nu are target space indices. The covariant derivatives are defined with respect to g mu nu, and r mu nu is the Ricci tensor in the target space. Usually, one looks for configurations which satisfy these conditions to first orders in alpha prime. For example, the simplest vacuum configuration for string theory is a flat spacetime and a constant dilaton. This automatically sets beta g mu nu to zero, but in order for beta phi to be zero, we have to choose the dimensionality of the target spacetime to be 26 in the case of bosonic strings. In general, we want to look for other vacuum configurations, and in particular, we will be interested in time-dependent background fields. Okay, before I move to that, let me just say that, as I mentioned before, the conformal invariance offers us a tool to move from the worldship theory to the to the physics in the target spacetime. We can find the equations of motion for the fields, and we can also look for an effective action in the target space that should provide us with exactly the same equations. Now let's look at configurations which are time dependent. They depend only on the time coordinate x0. In this case, the betas will also only depend on x0, and we look for configurations that satisfy these conditions. The first example of such a background is the linear dilaton, in which the metric is just flat. We have a Minkowski metric, but the dilaton is growing linearly in time, with the amplitude here just being a constant. This configuration satisfies the conformal invariance conditions as long as Q is chosen so that Q squared is equal to D minus 26 over 6 alpha prime. So this is a consistent background in a number of dimensions D different than 26. And we can actually see that this corresponds to an expanding universe. We have to look at the action of the effective theory to see this. And this is the form that it takes for the graviton and the dilaton in the linear dilaton models. We see in this action that the Einstein-Hilbert term does not take its canonical form, but the spacetime curvature is multiplied by a factor of e to the minus 2 phi. So, as usual, we need to change to the Einstein frame by making a redefinition of the metric of this form that involves the dilaton field. Since the dilaton field is time-dependent, then the metric in the Einstein frame becomes also time-dependent. From the form of the metric here, we can recognize x0 as actually being the conformal time coordinate in the target space. And by making a redefinition of this coordinate of this form, moving from x0 to t, we have our usual, we have the metric written in a usual Friedman-Robertson-Walker form with a scale factor that turns out to be growing linearly with time. So this was the first example of an expanding universe in string theory. Now, recently, a new time-dependent graviton and dilaton configuration was proposed by Jean Alexander, John Ellis, and Nick Mavromatos. This background involves a metric which is proportional to 1 over the time coordinate squared, with A being a constant here with dimensions length squared, and a dilaton which varies logarithmically in x0. Phi 0 is another dimensionless constant. This configuration does not satisfy the conformal invariance conditions to first orders in alpha prime. But it has this property of homogeneity that I will describe right now. And based on this one, the claim is that it satisfies the conformal invariance conditions to second order in alpha prime and to all higher orders. So this is the form that that the betas take to first order in alpha prime. So let me start from beta g mu nu. We see that it is proportional to 1 over x0 squared. And in the case of the 0, 0 component, we only have one term. While for the ij component, there are more than one terms to order alpha prime, but all of them are proportional to 1 over x0 squared. For the dilaton beta function, we have the three-level term, which is a constant. And then to order alpha prime, we have some other terms that are also constants for this specific configuration. Now, all the higher order corrections in the three beta functions will have the same dependence on x0. So all the terms in here and in here will be proportional to 1 over x0 squared, while all the terms in beta phi will be just constant. For example, in the dilaton Weyl anomaly coefficient, at order alpha prime squared, one gets a correction which is proportional to the Riemann tensor squared. For the specific configuration, this term is again proportional to a constant. And similarly, if we study all the possible terms that are allowed by general covariance in beta phi, they will all be constant. Similar arguments also show us that the terms in beta g mu nu will be proportional to 1 over x0 squared. So that in theory, the Weyl anomaly coefficients for this configuration should be an infinite series of this form. The graviton Weyl anomaly coefficient will always have a prefactor of 1 over time squared, and then they will be a sum of various constants. Here, AK and BK are dimensionless constants. Similarly, for the dilaton Weyl anomaly coefficient, this has no dependence on x0, it's just a sum of various constants. And also dimensional analysis shows us that each term of alpha prime will be accompanied by a factor of 1 over A, which is the amplitude of the graviton configuration and which has the same dimensions as alpha prime. Now, I will claim that these coefficients can be set to zero to an arbitrary order in alpha prime based on our freedom to perform field redefinitions in strings. So it is known that a general field redefinition that respects the covariance of the theory leaves the elements of the S matrix unaffected and is therefore a symmetry of the theory. So if we make a change from GI to GI tilde, we know that the S matrix elements do not change, but the Weyl anomaly coefficients do change, and they change like contravariant vectors in the space of couplings. So after a change of this type, the beta I's will change with a Lie derivative of this form. Now, wherever we have contractions here and here, we basically mean integration over all space-time coordinates. So for time-dependent backgrounds, this relation can be written like this. There should be a beta I tilde there. Anyway, this is the formula that we have been using to calculate the beta functions after we do some field redefinition. The fact that the field redefinitions are a symmetry of the theory but do change the beta functions is known to show a certain ambiguity in the definition of the Weyl anomaly coefficients themselves. So if we make, if for example we make a change in the background field, which is of first order in alpha prime, the change in the Weyl anomaly coefficients can be shown to be of second order in alpha prime. The first order coefficients will not change, but the second order coefficients will change. So now we're going to apply a field redefinition to the graviton and dilaton configuration that I showed before. We choose in particular to make a redefinition of this form. Inside the two brackets, we have terms that for this configuration are constants in time. The curvature and d phi are constants, and so is this term. And we also introduce a number of arbitrary dimensionless parameters, a1, 2, 3, and b1, 2, 3. So what this configuration does to the fields is that it rescales the graviton, and it only adds a constant to the dilaton field. But it also affects the Weyl anomaly coefficients. It brings in new terms to order alpha prime squared. So assuming that we know the form of the coefficients to second order in alpha prime, the one we started with, we will be able to write them like this. And as I said, we can assume that we know what the constants A, B, and C in these expressions are. And we know that most likely this is something that is non-zero. But after these sums are non-zero. But after we perform this redefinition, we get new terms inside the betas. And we move to new beta functions, which will have the same form. So we have checked that this redefinition brings in terms that still respect the homogeneity properties of the original beta function. So all they do is they change the values of the constants A, B, and C. Now, the new constants will depend on the original ones and on the parameters that we have introduced inside the redefinition.
Just to see if I understand correctly. First of all, if the theory was conformal, any field definition would not change. What you are doing here is constructing a conformal theory that is time dependent. And what if you would start with a theory that is not conformal, which dilaton was constant, can dilaton become time dependent in such a way that it will be conformal? Mm-hmm. What you do is field definition such that the dilaton will be linear in time. For that solution.
Sorry, I'm not sure I understand that point.
So the first question is that, of course, if you start with a conformal field, you do the definition, you would not change the fact that it is conformal. This field of redefinition that you are doing is a way of constructing a solution that is like equation.
Exactly, so my claim is that because the solutions are equivalent to each other, once you do a redefinition, you don't change the properties of the theory. The initial configuration is actually conformal. If all the terms in the beta function, all orders of alpha prime, are taken into account.
And you are going to such way of writing the field such that the linear dilaton is linear in time.
Yes, exactly. It's if you change it will be linear in time eventually.
You feel the definitions is that they don't change the first order in alpha prime.
Yes.
And that already seems.
This doesn't vanish, but let's say let's say A0 plus A1 alpha prime over A, that will be set to 0. The first order term will not vanish. The sum of the first and the second order term will vanish. Yes, and indeed, in this case, the question is, what is the relation of A to alpha prime? So if we assume that they are comparable, there is no reason why we should believe that we can just drop the higher order correction.
And then any point of view that you don't care because there's always a redefinition that includes them all.
Yes.
Yes.
If there's any other question up to here. Okay, so as I was saying, we have enough parameters in the redefinition that we introduced to make these new sums vanish. Now, the next non-zero terms will be of order alpha prime cubed, but we can do the same. We can repeat the procedure again to third order to make these new terms vanish if we make a redefinition of second order in alpha prime. And this can be repeated in principle to all higher orders. So the claim is that...
Can you get away with doing that just...
For the massive fields. No, and this is one of the things that I wanted to comment on later on, that when we say that this is exact in alpha prime, we do not mean that we have taken into account all the massive degrees of freedom whose masses come as 1 over alpha prime. So we have, yes, we've only looked at the lowest states.
But you did look at the massless states that are not acting on
the, for example, the Binu.
Yeah.
Yes. I should have mentioned it. It was in another work. This was by Jean Alexander again and another guy named Dylan Tanner. They looked at the antisymmetric tensor, and they also found a configuration which can fit with the graviton and the dilaton, and again has the same properties. I think that in that case, Binu nu had to have the same dependence on x0 as Gnu nu in order to get the same homogeneous terms.
So it had to be non-zero to have a good function zero?
It can also be zero. It can also be zero because that would just set the zero terms in, and sorry.
It's a risk game.
No, if Binu was zero.
If it was non zero, you said it's just, it has the same form.
So yes. Yes, but the anti symmetric field.
Just a question.
And for the tachyon, I will also include that. That's the next step, is to also include the tachyon.
To follow up on the previous, you have some argument that I shouldn't be worried about the massless states when I'm starting to worry about curvatures, or is that just something that we're looking at?
No. I don't have any argument other than the usual argument that they are massive enough so that they decouple from the.
You're talking about alpha prime curvatures, right?
So. Alpha prime corrections, as long as we stick to to massless states and to perturbative strings. So we haven't looked at it. It's and I'm not sure we really know how to do this either. Okay, so I think I've been through this now. And as a next step, we also consider a tachyon background with the same dependence on time as the dilaton. So tau naught is another constant, and the tachyon is logarithmic in next zero. In this case, the Weyl anomaly coefficients almost have the same homogeneity properties. Besides one term in the tachyon Weyl anomaly coefficient. So if we look at the first order terms in beta t, we have a three-level term, which is not a constant. It's proportional to the field itself, so it grows as a logarithm of x0. Whereas all the terms at order alpha prime and all higher order terms are constants. But we saw that even this term can be removed by another field redefinition, which again does not change the dependence of the fields on x0. In particular, the redefinition that we have to consider in this case to make all the, this will be a redefinition to order alpha prime, and it will bring in new terms up to order alpha prime squared in the beta function that will be homogeneous to the existing ones, and it will make the sum in each beta vanish. So again, inside the brackets, we only have constant terms that rescale the metric, add a constant to the dilaton and a constant to the tachyon. But we also have a rescaling of the tachyon field. And it is this term whose coefficient C I have separated from all the other parameters in the redefinition that gets rid of the linear term in beta T. So as I said, the fields keep their dependence on X0. And then as long as the parameter C is chosen to have this specific value, then the new order alpha prime squared coefficients can be set to zero by also choosing the values of some of the other 18 parameters that we have introduced. So again, this configuration, following the same arguments, is a consistent background to all orders in alpha prime, up to a definition which does not change the dependence of the fields on X0. As I said, this configuration is exact in alpha prime, but everything is based on perturbative string theory. This is not a non-perturbative solution. And this is important because the concept of field redefinitions is only well defined in the context of perturbative string theory. So,
I'm confused about it. Seems that if I look on how long in proper time you will run into strong coupling, it seems to be very large. Right? Because the metric goes like one over p square, and the dilaton is linear.
The dilaton is logarithmic in this T, but then when you when you change in a frame where the linear where the dilaton will be linear in T, it depends on the value of phi naught actually whether the string coupling will run to large or to small values.
Okay, so first, suppose it runs too large.
This will be. Excuse me, sir.
Can't you have some. Maybe either in the future, in one of the two, it gets big, doesn't it?
Yes, so if we want it, at least in the future, to be small, we can just set a constraint on the value of phi naught. And this will be the consistent solution. Self-consistent.
I was thinking there was work written by Friedman, Hendrik, and Lawrence, where they did something similar but from a different point of view. They just wrote in like an equation of motion for how the dilaton and the other field will develop in time, or thought about the dilaton as time. And you are like going to engage the dilaton this time or log of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I expect your field redefinition to trivialize their equations. What they have found is that I think generically you run into strong coupling problem really fast.
I don't know what this works, so I can't really help. But I mean, in this case, you will basically have the string coupling being proportional to X0. So, to the power phi naught. So if, yes, so it then depends. If when the proper time goes to infinity, X0 goes to zero, then you can say that if phi naught is greater than zero, then the string coupling is small. Otherwise, the opposite thing. you can okay. Okay. So
can I ask, you said, if you go back one slide, you say it's not non-perturbative. Does that just mean you've done everything in perturbations theory? Or are you making a stronger statement that this really fails to be a non-perturbative solution?
I would say that we have done everything in perturbative. And also something that I have not mentioned here is that this configuration, we also arrived to it through a different method that I didn't talk about here at all. It was a method for controlling the quantum amplitudes of the theory with respect to alpha prime, and we applied that to the theory on the sphere. So we assumed that the worst it was a sphere. We didn't consider any higher string loops. I don't know if it fails in the non-perturbative regime, but definitely we have done it in the perturbative regime. So now if we want to look at the effective theory for this model, we need an action for this. And as I said, this can be derived from the fundamental worldview theory. However, although the effective action for open string backgrounds has been studied quite extensively, especially in relation to D-brain actions, this is not the case for closed string tachyons. So there is a proposal that relates the effective action with the worldview partition function Z, and again the Weyl anomaly coefficients, and this leads to this form for the effective action. Now, this action was dismissed by Chaitlin himself because it doesn't reproduce the standard perturbative vacuum for closed strings. But in our case, it doesn't seem that this vacuum configuration should be somehow connected to the flat metric and the zero tachyon fields. So there is no reason why to dismiss this action a priori. And indeed, this is what we're going to start with. However, since there seem to be ambiguities in the part of the action that refers to the tachyon, one may also want to consider more general actions. And to first order in alpha prime, the most general action that one can write will involve these functions of the tachyon field. In particular, the form of F1 will be very important because it determines the way to move from the string to the Einstein frame. So our first choice for F1 will be an exponential of minus the tachyon field. If I start with the solution in the sigma model frame, this can be turned into a de Sitter metric after the time coordinate is redefined in this way. From x0, we move to x0 bar, and then we have a scale factor which is growing exponentially with time, and a Hubble rate being proportional to the inverse of the square root of the graviton amplitude A. In After this change of coordinates, the dilaton and the tachyon also become linear in time. Now, when we move to the in order to move to the Einstein frame, we need to make a redefinition for the metric, which will involve the dilaton and the tachyon fields in this way. So, if we accept this proposal for the function f1 of t, then the function omega that appears in the redefinition of the metric will become minus 4 times 5 minus 2 times the tachyon field over this factor. And for the specific configuration that we have, when both the dilaton and the tachyon depend logarithmically on x0, this will be a time-dependent function of this form. Now, the interesting thing about this is that if it happens that the values of phi node and tau node are such that this factor is equal to zero, then the metric in the Einstein frame is exactly the same as the metric in the string frame. So if this condition, which basically says that the tachyon and the dilaton fields, let's say, anti-align themselves in a specific way, if this relation holds, then we have a scale factor in the Einstein frame growing exponentially with time. If this is not true, then we have a more general power law expansion in the Einstein frame, with the rate of expansion being set again by the values of phi node and tau node. And it turns out that if this sum is greater than zero, this describes an accelerating expansion, whereas if this relation holds, this is a flat universe. Just a few more comments before I move on. As I said, first of all, this configuration is consistent with the conformal invariance conditions up to field redefinitions, and this is true in any number of target space-time dimensions. We haven't set any value for d so far, so we can just choose d equals 4 if we want, and thus one may be able to build toy models for expanding universes in four dimensions. Now, because this has to be consistent with perturbative string theory, we want to check also some other things. So this is what I have already discussed. If the string coupling has to be small at late times, for some of the solutions, the accelerating ones, phi node has to be greater than zero. Otherwise, the string coupling is small only if phi node is less than zero. Furthermore, a problem for string theory and for any quantum field theory in curved space times is the presence of horizons, which would rule out all kinds of eternally accelerating solutions. The answer to this problem would be that an inflationary phase should only last for a limited time in our model. So one should look for a way to exit from inflation in this model, probably through disturbing this condition for the dilaton and the tachyon amplitudes that makes the Einstein frame metric be inflationary as well. An open question is whether we have been really using the correct effective action. In other words, if the function f1 is not an exponential of minus the tachyon field, then we might have some other behavior in the Einstein frame. And finally, another proposal was made by John Alexander and Nick Mavromatos, namely that the tachyon field should have this this logarithmic dependence on x zero, but it should be treated as an off-cell field, in the sense that we don't require that there exists such a redefinition that cancels the inhomogeneous term in its beta function, and so that this this approach is consistent even if horizons do exist. But I don't want to say more about this now.
Can you say something more about what's wrong with horizons?
What's wrong with horizons? The concept of in and out states is not well defined, so that if we have a perturbative approach and we want to define an S matrix, this leads to
problems. Well, in the context of cosmology, that sounds like a much more serious problem, whether or not there are horizons.
You mean the S matrix, or
if you just had a radiation-filled universe? What's the S matrix?
Yes, that is that is. Are you saying that this is too hard a statement and too strong?
I'm asking. I'm suggesting. I don't understand why the boundary is drawn between space time with horizons and space time without horizons. Since the S matrix, naively, I would have said it has a lot of problems in any cosmological situation.
I don't really know what to say on this, but I guess that if there are horizons, it even has more problems.
Singularity, for example.
This has no singularity, however, for example, this kind of solution.
So what's the asymptotic behavior in the early past and early and late future?
It's the sitter, so it doesn't have an initial singularity.
But it's the sitter, but you said you don't like. I mean, the sitter.
I see what you mean. You mean once we exit from this?
Yeah.
Okay, so if I may move to the next slide. For example, ideally, maybe just. To make a simple model, one would want something that would interpolate between flat and flat, and somewhere in the middle have an inflationary phase, for example. And indeed, we did check what kind of choices for this function f1 would lead to behaviors like this, but. Of course, this is more like a guess, not
so
anything
when you say
else.
No horizons, you really mean you want an initial flat?
If this
and a final flat.
Yes, this would be really ideal for studying other things, because our hope was also, for example, to study string production and things like this. This is why we looked at really. Easy models like this one, but I.
I'm sorry, I'm not quite getting what the what you're trying to do here. I mean, first of all, I think when you say flat, you mean Minkowski.
In this case, yes.
Okay, but. I'm still also puzzled by what you mean with inflation here, because normally with inflation you want this period in the very early universe, you want your inflaton to be coupled with other matter fields so that you can get perturbations, you connect it with, you know, in a sort of nice radiative era with the sort of, you know, the universe that we have. But what you've been talking about before is like a sort of an exact solution, but you seem to be relying very much on this dependence in time to do all these field redefinitions, and but to me, when you say field redefinition, that's sort of something quite formal, but if I've got other fields around it, I know which frame I'm supposed to be in, I know what my physical frame is, and then I know how to do perturbation theory around that. How is that being affected by all this redefinition? That's sort of not clear. It's not clear to me how this is going to be implemented physically for our universe.
So one question would be how would matter fields, for example, would be affected under such redefinitions?
Well, I guess I'm not really sure where the matter fields are.
Yes, exactly. So this, as I said, is nothing more than a toy model, really. And the only reason why we're using the word inflation is because we get a background that is the sitter. But this is indeed a background solution. We don't have an inflaton field, and we haven't been able to study any perturbations so far.
I mean, would the perturbations sort of, because of your field redefinitions, I mean, would that interfere with the perturbations?
I'd have to say no, and as you said, the physical frame is only one. It's the Einstein frame, and the effect of these redefinitions on the configurations is such that it only changes some coefficients, but not really the form of the fields. So I don't think that this should be a problem when looking at other fields coupled.
This is kind of a related question then, is that because you said several times that you've got an exact solution, you know, perfectly on time. Whereas my understanding of the earlier exchange was that what that means is that for some specific field directions you think you have an exact solution, but for other directions you haven't checked yet, other than the massive change yet, for example. So you don't know you've satisfied all the equations for the orbit around time. And that might be related in the physics. So a question could you do that, you know, is there a way to fix that? And in the spirit of what you're doing, is there a way of phrasing what you're doing as if I kind of turn every field on which transforms the same way, you know, consistent with the symmetries that allow yourself, like space is very homogeneous and everything. You'd have other fields that you'd be having to turn on, like scalars that were massive string states and tensors that were massive string states. And in principle, you might have a solution where they're all turned on, they're all scaling the time the same way, just some coefficients for every one. And then the constants you're talking about, that you have been talking about in the redefinitions of the phases you are looking at, might be to do with mixing the fields you're looking at with fields you haven't turned on. And the solution that needn't exist is the one where those things are all zero, but there might be a solution where they're all not zero, but mixing somehow. Which is still be interesting if you had something like that.
But we haven't looked at
but it seems like with the tools you're using, you're not identifying these coefficients, you're just making an argument that you have enough constants that you could find the solution.
Yes, but I didn't. So, for example, here, the truth is I don't have. We can also talk about this later. But for example, at this simple example, we have actually said how much A1, A2, and A3, and B1, 2, 3 should be in order to make this thing work. I mean, to first orders, it's something that we have actually done by hand.
But you've also said that there's nothing that says that's bigger, smaller than the terms that you didn't do. But you didn't know the thing. You know that there are solutions and so on. Mm-hmm. You don't care so much for the value. Those corrections are there, but it's just changing the number, whose value you don't really care about. Because there's often when you're making an ansatz, there's an argument that says that if you write the most general ansatz consistent with symmetry, then you guarantee that there will exist a solution. And you may not know what it is, but maybe you can find it. But it sounds like a lot of what you're doing is talking about the existence of a solution where you know the time kind of the coefficient.
Yes, I would say this is true. So yes, we're claiming that a solution exists which has this dependence on time, but what the exact form of the coefficient is, we don't know. Or they should be in principle, they should include all corrections to all orders in Alphabra.
So the missing step is that there may be other scalars and other tensors higher in the string levels that are also scaling with prime and single.
Yes, probably.
That might be interesting.
Yes.
I think Cliff might be asking, could you just make the same general argument
for all
the massive models as well?
I guess if I knew what the equations of motion for these modes were as well, then maybe yes. But we haven't looked at it, and I'm not sure whether one could make a general argument for all the massive modes. Let me get back, and I think that. Okay, because I'm also running out of time. If I can just very briefly talk to you about another possible application of this technique, which would involve a time-dependent gauge field. So the equation of motion for a gauge field, we know that we can get it out of the DBI action, and this has the advantage that it is exact in the field strength, and in this way it is also exact in alpha prime as long as any derivative corrections are ignored. But in principle, one could also have corrections of derivatives of F. The equation of motion for the gauge field arising from the DBI action turns out to be homogeneous for a gauge field which is time dependent and whose spatial components depend linearly on x0, where the ui here is just a constant vector. They are homogeneous if, again, we assume the same graviton and dilaton configurations. So if we believe the argument that I've made so far, this is again, a kind of exact solution in alpha prime. Now, these kinds of gauge field backgrounds actually arise in certain models that have been called the D-particle foam models. My supervisor, Nick Mavromatos, and other collaborators have been developing such models where basically we have a bulk spacetime filled with D0 brains. These models have some interesting properties, such as they may provide some non-zero dark energy component. People have also been studying the refractive index for the vacuum in these models and other things. But for what I'm trying to say here, the important thing is that the interaction of the D particles with the closed strings in the bulk spacetime can be effectively described by a gauge field which has the form that I showed before. And the way to see this is I consider it a very simple it's really a toy model again. We just have a space-time filled with D particles, and we assume that we live on a D3 plane in this space-time. We assume that the bulk graviton and dilaton have again this form, and then because of the presence of the D particles, the world sheet action. One should add a specific operator to the world sheet action that takes this form where ui is the velocity of the D particles, which in general should be a stochastic quantity. So we are assuming that the D particles move randomly in the bulk spacetime because they are recoiling with the closed strings in the bulk spacetime. Now, this vertex operator is equivalent to a gauge field of this form, which is exactly what I showed before. And the interesting thing about this is that it leads to a homogeneous equation of motion for the gauge field, even if higher derivative corrections are included in this equation. So this time-dependent background is in principle conformal, again in the same sense, up to field, up to suitable field redefinitions, even if higher derivative corrections are taken into account. I wanted to mention this just as another application of the resummation technique, and I have to say that this is still a work in progress. We are trying to study a bit the role of such time-dependent fields in cosmology. So I think I can stop here. I think the main point, which has been the technique of finding such exact in alpha prime backgrounds, has been made. And I'd like to thank you very much for having me here. And we'll ask you any questions. Sorry. Yes. Will you give me one like this?
So you've seen the New
England. If there are any. Yes, whether it's really convergent is another thing that we have not checked.
Well, okay, but essentially you're canceling, you're adding essentially bigger and bigger terms at higher and higher orders to cancel off previous things.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's conditionally convergent, as you probably know, right, you can always, by rearranging a conditionally convergent sum, you can make its value be anything you want. So can you really say you're satisfying the
if zero is among the things that you can make it, and if all of these things are equivalent because they are related to each other. This is the way in which we say that it is conformally invariant.
Okay.
Because zero is among the values that the beta functions can take that are equivalent to each other.
Okay, if it's conditionally convergent, as it might look like, maybe that's wrong. But if it is, then I can also rearrange
I'm not sure I have an answer to that.
You're trying to argue that doing these field redefinitions in some sense isn't affecting the real physics, which is the S matrix, the parallels and the angles, etc. That's not worried about, but there is an S matrix. So is this something you can compute in the original model? Before doing any, since the physics are supposed to be set, this is something you can compute in the original model before doing any field redefinitions that would convince me that it does make sense.
That it makes sense as a string background,
yeah.
Or
it looks like we changed the mass of some configuration to have like, for example.
Right. I mean, it looks like the original thing that we thought was the mass
was gravitational. Yeah, or you take some game relation that would have mirrors in the plastic, so I'd say, no, now it has negative mass, according to some Hamiltonian definition.
But this should not be the case because the field redefinition should not also change the mass of the spectrum.
Well,
the
I think they'll really do that. That should not happen if it looks like you're in danger originally.
No, this does not happen. The masses in the spectrum. Same by under this definition.
Well, normally that's the perturbative. So the way you separate it, that's not like a curve environment. You say that you curve around some configuration, then you don't change things order by order and expansion. So once you start, so this is always worrisome that there's these equations you don't know if you're satisfied or not. So you don't know if you're proving your solution. And the thing that you're proving is not a small parameter. You can certainly do field reductions that change the estimate. So you can do 5 goes to 1 over box 5. The statement of the important, whatever the theorem that is, the statement is that if you do a redefinition that doesn't introduce singularities, that would be giving you in the process of going from a green function to an estimate, there's new poles. That's the kind of thing that's not dangerous. So normally, you're curve normalizing the fact that you're taking the field in the field plus the corrections. But if those corrections are not small, then it's a little bit worrisome. You'd like to have a check, it's a lot, just make sure it's all.
Okay. I guess that there are some consistency things to be checked. Yeah.
So, to me, the most striking thing was you claimed that the theory became well defined in any dimension just by the introduction of this
time-dependent
background. And yet, this background is only if you're trying to make a realistic model. It's only on cosmological scales that it doesn't look like flat space time. So I don't know if that's a contradiction, but it seems strange. How is it that just these very large scale infrared effects, so to speak, are making the theory consistent? See what I'm saying?
No.
I mean, we live in an apartment. If this is our, if this background is supposed to be describing something like our world now, and then we're living almost in a flat space-time. I mean, these time dependencies are very small. Mm-hmm. So how are they able to convert an inconsistent theory? You know? How are they able to restore conformal invariance on laboratory scales? I mean, I'm not sure this is a question is correctly posed, but then I think that's the worry that's the issue I'm trying to raise.
But I don't see how the conformal invariance on the world speed would be related to the scales in our universe.
Well, the string has some sort of size, effectively.
Which is exactly incorporated in these alpha prime corrections.
So are you saying it's becoming a huge world?
No, I wouldn't.
No, I think I agree with the question not being well posed. I mean, okay. This is a baby step in a direction, a certain direction, but it's not yet describing the universe that we live in. So I think you're trying to extrapolate from where it's really not valid. Yeah.
Probably.
Okay. So would you kind of extrapolate?
In the vein of extrapolating, you talked about you were going to do cosmology, but in some sense, this game says that I have an exact solution, but I don't really know what it's an exact solution of. And so, for example, if you want to do perturbations in cosmology, how are you going to approach that?
In the case of
You talked about structure for growth.
Yes. So I want to perturb this gauge field. In particular, in this model with the deep particles, because eventually at some point I'm going to, this UIs represent, let's say, the velocities of the deep particles. So these things on average are zero. So this gauge field on average should be zero. But then the idea is to consider perturbations on that and just take the equations of motion and perturb them.
But can you see, is there a way to think about fluctuations, say, of the metric around your background?
Hopefully, yes. In the same way. I mean, we don't say what this constant is, but we perturb around that.
I don't want to keep people. Maybe I can ask you that.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.